It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferriat. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to two Wisconsin lawmakers about a bipartisan bill being voted on in the state legislature that would encourage veterans to get into farming. We'll learn more in just a bit.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics.
After the terror attack in Lower Manhattan yesterday, President Trump was quick to criticize a lottery program for immigrants to the United States and the lawmakers he said had supported it.
I am today starting the process of terminating the diversity lottery program. I'm going to ask Congress to immediately initiate work to get rid of this program.
We'll look more closely at the president's remarks on immigration later today on Central Time.
And Washington is still at the center of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. This week, George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to lying to investigators who were part of Mueller's investigation.
You can share your thoughts on either of those stories by calling 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think of the president's calls to end the diversity visa lottery program? Should the president be singling out lawmakers who backed it? And what are your thoughts on the latest on the Mueller probe? Call 800-642-1234.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian, and she's back with us to look at those stories and more. Sabrina, nice to have you back on the show again.
Thanks for having me. Happy.
Yep. Sabrina, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Well, I want to talk first about the president's response to the attack in New York City. One of the responses from the president turning to look at Chuck Schumer, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and how he may, according to the president, have been attached to the diversity visa lottery program. What has the president said there?
Well, there are a couple key points here, and one is that when the president tweeted that the suspected attacker in New York came through what is known as the Diversity Immigrant Visa Program, also referred to as the Green Card Lottery, that was not something U.S. officials had confirmed themselves. Now, obviously, the president has access to classified information, but this was another example of him disseminating that information on Twitter, which is a way he often communicates. And Chuck Schumer was he played a key role in crafting this program in the early 1990s. It essentially is to boost immigration from countries where you have significantly lower rates of people coming to the United States. So up to 55,000 visas are distributed annually to a random assortment of countries. But that is not to say that those individuals do not go through background checks. In fact, they are subject to a pretty significant and lengthy vetting process. And also, it's worth noting this was passed, the visa program, diversity visa program, as part of a broader immigration bill with overwhelming bipartisan support and signed by President George H.W. Bush, who, of course, is a Republican himself.
Well, so specifically, how connected is Senator Schumer to that program?
Well, I would say that, you know, he, of course, was part of the lawmakers who were involved in shaping what it looked like back in the early 1990s. I mean, as mentioned, it was established under the Immigration Act of 1990. But there have been concerns that the program does not have maybe sufficient information from some of these countries with respect to alleviating some of the national security concerns. So there have been lawmakers who suggested revisiting this, and one of those lawmakers is Chuck Schumer himself, because the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill, the so-called Gang of Eight Bill in 2013, that was very hotly debated and contested in the Senate, that would have actually eliminated this diversity visa program. And Chuck Schumer was one of the Democratic co-sponsors of that bill. So there are some key facts that are being left out of this narrative in a highly unusual way, in fact, for this terrorist attack to be politicized, which inherently terrorist attacks are politicized nowadays, but specifically, for a member of an opposing party or any party to be targeted as the reason why an attack would transpire. That's highly unusual.
And how has Senator Schumer responded to the president's tweets about him?
Well, I think that Senator Schumer, in his remarks on the he took the Senate floor this morning, and in his remarks tried to draw a contrast between President Trump And President George W. Bush, of course, who was in office at the time of 9/11, not only the last terrorist attack in New York City, but of course, the largest terrorist attack the United States has dealt with. And he said that, you know, President Bush at the time invited both me and Hillary Clinton, then also a senator from New York, to the White House. He put forth a message of unity. So I think Schumer's tactic here is to not really engage on the merits of the specific visa program, and something that is a lot more in the weeds politically and will be debated potentially in the coming weeks or months. But, you know, I think that one of the things you also saw was Jeff Flake, who, you know, is a Republican senator from Arizona, who said he would retire last week from the Senate, and who's a vocal critic of Trump. He also came to Schumer's defense on Twitter because he was part of that 2013 Gang of Eight effort, and said to the president, well, you know, Chuck Schumer was part of this bill that I also co-sponsored that would have ended this program, which was his way, a Republican's way of saying that this attack is out of bounds and also misleading.
Sabrina Siddiqui is with us right now. She's a political reporter for The Guardian as we look back at the top stories this week in national politics. And Sabrina, former Trump aide George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to lying to federal agents who worked on Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. What effect has his indictment have, or what is it expected to have?
Well, I think that this was actually the bigger bombshell on Monday, because Paul Manafort is someone who we knew was the subject of Robert Mueller's inquiry, the former campaign manager, of course, of the Trump campaign. But someone like George Papadopoulos was not really in the spotlight. And it was certainly not known that he's already been cooperating with the FBI since at least July. And I think that this really sent a signal to other individuals, whether they're associates of the Trump campaign or just individuals who figure into this broader inquiry into Russian interference in the U.S. election, that you have a choice here. You can either cooperate with the special counsel, or, you know, we could bring you in on more significant charges, especially because there are witnesses now who are working with federal agents. And the fact of the matter is that those who are somewhat connected to this Russia investigation, and certainly those who are the subject of it, they don't know what Robert Mueller knows. Only he knows what he knows so far. And so I think that kind of putting out Papadopoulos is a way of potentially attracting bigger fish, so that, you know, they could potentially reach a plea deal if they're willing to cooperate, and certainly if they're willing to hand over documents and other information that could help determine if there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Moscow.
And the White House so far has been saying that George Papadopoulos was kind of a bit player, didn't have a big role, minimizing his role in the campaign. Is that message still the tack that they're taking?
Well, that has certainly been the message they've put out, not just with respect to Papadopoulos, but also with respect to Paul Manafort. Now, with Paul Manafort, when you're talking about the former chairman of the campaign who was brought into that role during the Republican National Convention, where Trump formally accepted the nomination, that's a more difficult of an argument to make. Papadopoulos, of course, is a lesser-known figure. They also tried to do the same with Carter Page, that these are low-level foreign policy advisors who weren't really instrumental to the campaign. But the problem is that there is audio of Trump introducing his foreign policy advisory team, mentioning people like Papadopoulos and Carter Page by name. There is a photo in which Papadopoulos is seated at the table with Trump just a few feet away. So they can't argue that there was really no contact between Papadopoulos and, forget senior figures in the campaign, but the candidate himself. Also, he reported to Sam Clovis, who was in a much higher ranking position in the campaign and is now actually a nominee, or Trump's nominee, to be the chief scientist at the Department of Agriculture. So that too might become a contentious nomination.
Now, these indictments have been framed as the first indictments, and we had a guest on yesterday who said that there were maybe whispers that there would be indictments coming down as of last week, Wednesday. Are you hearing anything else now that would indicate that there might be more action coming up?
I think there certainly are expected to be more indictments, but it seems like the tactic here on Mueller's part is as we just alluded to, trying and compelling more witnesses to come forward. It's sort of that classic move on the part of the FBI when they're going after a mob that, you know, if you bring people in on, if you go after people on other charges, in the case of Manafort and Gates, there are many charges listed among them, money laundering and the tax evasion and other such charges. They're not specifically related to Russian interference in the U.S. election. That's a way to sort of force them to be cooperators. And I think that that's sort of the signal before any more indictments come down, so that if there are others, certainly someone like Michael Flynn, who has so far avoided cooperating in any way with Mueller or even or investigators on Capitol Hill, that, you know, if you don't want to be indicted, there's still an opportunity here to come forward.
Sabrina Siddiqui stays with us now. She's a political reporter at The Guardian as we look at the top stories in national politics for a weekly look at politics out of Washington.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think of the president's calls to end the diversity visa lottery program? If you're following the Russia probe, tell us, what do you think of the indictments announced earlier this week? What do you think it means? What do you think of the president's response to both of these issues? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our look at the week in Washington with Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think of the political response, the White House response to yesterday's attack in New York? How about the indictments in the Mueller investigation? What are you watching for? What do you think of what's happened lately? And what do you think of Chief of Staff, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly's remarks on the Civil War this week? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Let's take one call on the Mueller investigation. We've got Mike joining us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to ask your guest about Manafort's daughter and son-in-law and how Mueller might leverage Manafort to, I guess, giving up more information in order to protect his daughter, and also how would Mueller leverage the state courts, New York State, in order to keep Trump from simply being able to pardon Manafort or his daughter in any federal indictment?
Mike, thank you for that. And Sabrina, have you heard anything about Paul Manafort's family?
Yes, the reason that his daughter is at the subject of the headlines is because she reportedly texted friends about how close her father, Paul Manafort, was to Trump during the campaign. And so that actually undermines the White House argument that Paul Manafort was somewhat distant from the campaign and didn't really know or work closely with Trump himself, when in fact the public record shows that Manafort and Trump have known each other for decades. So, you know, these are certainly, I don't know in terms of how his family might be involved, but they're certainly potential witnesses. It's not out of the question that they would potentially be called for an interview with the FBI. As far as the question is about pardons, I think that it's not out of the realm of possibility that the president pardons Paul Manafort. That is something that he has the power to do. But I think that what I'm hearing from Republicans on Capitol Hill is it would be highly unwise for the president to pardon any of these high-profile figures in this investigation, or frankly speaking, any of the individuals whose names have been put out by the special counsel, because that would be directly interfering with the investigation, and that could be a red line even for Republicans who so far have tried to keep out of the president's way and tried not to focus too much on this inquiry.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. And Sabrina, let's talk taxes now. News this morning that the GOP tax plan reveal is getting delayed. Looks like maybe tomorrow. What do we know about why?
Well, there are a number of disagreements over the tax plan, specifically how do you pay for these tax cuts? And there are some revenue generators that the Republicans have identified, one of which is to eliminate the state and local tax deduction. But you have Republicans from high tax states, for example, New York, New Jersey, some in even Pennsylvania, who are highly opposed to eliminating those particular deductions. So that's one sticking point. And I think they're looking for some sort of assurance that even if this is removed from the House version, that it's not reinstated when the Senate takes up a bill, if they're able to pass something through the House. And then you have the fiscal conservatives who believe that this is not what they campaigned on, because it certainly, according to analyses, would balloon the deficit. And this party has run on fiscal responsibility. So I think that you've got a number of concerns that are holding it up at the moment. And the question really is, are we looking at healthcare 2.0 or maybe even 3.0? We already had two versions of healthcare, but is this going to similarly fall to divisions within the Republican Party and not even make it pass through the Senate? Right now, it's not even clear if this is going to come up for a vote anytime soon in the House.
And Republicans need a win, as you referenced, after failures on health care. And this has been seen as lower hanging fruit, something that should be doable to get to some point of consensus. And the president has been weighing in, saying he wants real progress on this, wants it pretty much done before the holidays. Does it seem likely that that will happen?
Well, it's hard to imagine that this entire issue will be dealt with before the holidays. I mean, if you look back, for example, at health care, the House did ultimately pass its own version of an Obamacare repeal, but only because the moderates who had raised concerns with the House bill wanted to kick it over to the Senate and said, the Senate will fix this bill, they'll improve it, and then they'll send it back to us. As we know with health care, the Senate didn't even take up the House bill. They started to put forth their own plans. Those all fell apart, and then the issue was just tabled. So I think that, you know, what you could see is House Republicans do something similar where they can go back to their districts and say that they passed something. Maybe if they are able to resolve these differences, they bring something to the floor for a vote, or they just say, again, we're going to kick this over to the Senate. You know, we've done our part. Now they can do theirs. And again, you'll run into even more obstacles with the Senate, where there's only 52 Republicans in the chamber. They can only afford to lose two votes under this simple majority process known as reconciliation. And so I just how it's foreseeable that they would be able to act this quickly, especially because not only have they not resolved divisions within their own party, but they're also out on recess for quite a bit of time, too. So there's a very limited time for them to get this done.
And another important story in a week of important stories, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly has been the subject of controversy for remarks he made about the Civil War. And here's a clip of what he said in an interview with Laura Ingraham.
Well, history's history. There's certain things in history that were not so good and other things that were very, very good. I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now it's different today. But the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War.
So Kelly saying the lack of ability to compromise led to the Civil War. This has been very contentious. People having very different reactions. What have you seen?
Well, I think that this certainly prompted a pretty swift criticism because in some ways it harkened back to the president blaming both sides in the wake of the attack in Charlottesville, suggesting they were very fine people on both sides. Obviously, people's views have shifted, the public's views have shifted significantly with respect to the Confederacy and the two sides within the Civil War. And there's also a bit of revisionist history here, of course, because suggesting that there was an inability to compromise overlooks a long history of compromises that were made to reflect pro-slavery forces. Not to mention, critics have pointed out, if you're looking back at this today, I mean, the fundamental question was whether or not people were willing to compromise on the issue of enslavement. So I think that, you know, it's unclear why the chief of staff is out here wading into these culture wars. It's also maybe more telling that John Kelly, who has been very much framed as an adult in the room and has tried to instill discipline in the White House, in many ways, people believe that there's been more and more evidence as he puts himself out there that he's more of a believer and from more of an ideological standpoint in this president and the message on that he has put out on issues of immigration, criminal justice, race relations. So I don't think this is a conversation that the White House wanted to have. In fact, you just had at today's briefing, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, say that it's deeply offensive that anyone would suggest that any individual in the White House is in favor of slavery. And the fact that she even had to make that statement speaks to the conversation that is being had in the White House, much less in 2017.
And Sabrina, lastly, in our last minute together here, former President Barack Obama is no longer in office, obviously, but that doesn't mean he's kicking back. His foundation has been swinging into higher gear, looking at getting involved in civics. What's the foundation doing?
Well, this, I think, is going back to the roots for former President Obama, who, of course, began, as a community organizer, focusing on the political process and how do you get more people engaged to be especially young activists and part of the civic culture. I think one of the things that he's focusing on is the breakdown of our politics. And he did this in much more veiled terms through his foundation. I don't think he wants it to be a very political. So he didn't name Trump. He's stuck with his policy of not naming President Trump since leaving office in January. But certainly I think he was trying to speak to this as a pivotal moment, why more and more people should be engaged in the democratic process if they do want to be agents of change.
Sabrina, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian, joining us for our Week in Washington segment.
First, agriculture is a big economic driver here in Wisconsin. That's no secret. It generates more than $88 billion a year in the state. While farming is an important piece of the state's economy, the number of farms and a drop in the number of people who want to get into agriculture has been a cause for concern.
But a bipartisan bill before the state legislature provides assistance for Wisconsin's veterans to encourage them to go into agriculture.
We've got two lawmakers supporting that bill here with us now. Patrick Teston is a Republican senator in the state Senate. He represents Stevens Point. Senator Teston, thanks for joining us.
Great to be on.
And Evan Goyke is a Democrat representing Milwaukee in the state assembly. Representative Goyke, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, we've got two sides of this. There's the veterans and there's the farming. Let's start on the farming side. Senator Teston, what are we seeing in agriculture right now that has you worried as part of, as the supply of farmers goes?
It's an aging demographic. We live in a state that when you take a look at our population that's 65 or older, that population is going to increase over the next two decades by 72%. And when you take a look at our agricultural community, the average age of our farmer is in their late 50s. And we need to get a new generation of farmers interested in the field to make sure that our $88 billion agricultural industry doesn't lag behind.
And Representative Goyke, we don't necessarily have the succession plans in place. There isn't that new generation out there taking over the farms, is there?
That's correct. It's just interesting to be on and talking about this. I represent part of the central city of Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. There are zero farms in my district. My district is just over 3,500 acres, which may be smaller than some farms in Senator Teston's district, yet we are farming. And this bill encourages both urban farmers and rural farmers. And so if we're going to get creative in talking about who our future farmers are, they're going to come from cities as well.
So we've got a demand problem on that side. And now we see a supply maybe of veterans who could get into farming. Can you talk about, Senator Teston, veterans in the Wisconsin workforce?
Well, sure. And really, this whole idea came about from the program that's been implemented in West Virginia back in, I believe it was 2014. And to do just that, to help veterans go into agriculture. You know, when you take a look, our men and women who put on the uniform are some of the hardest working and bravest individuals that we have in our country. And oftentimes when they come back from their tours of service, many of them have scars that are visible and some that aren't. And studies have shown that the rigorous work that comes along with farming is very therapeutic. It helps with things like PTSD. In the West Virginia program, eight veterans went on record and said because of this program, it actually prevented them from taking their own lives.
Wow.
And so we see this as an opportunity to really point them in the right direction to, one, make sure that we continue strong egg tradition in this state, but more importantly, that veterans have an outlet and an avenue to pursue when, after their service to our country.
And Representative Goyke, what would this legislation do ultimately if passed?
So if passed, there would be the creation of a department within the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection, specifically designed around veterans in agriculture, both veterans that are currently farming and those that are interested in a career in agriculture. And it would supply those men and women and their families with education, training, mentorship, hopefully a one-stop source for answers to daunting questions of people that want to get involved in agriculture. The second thing it would do is create a state-sponsored logo type that veteran farmers could use in the sale of their products, and that I'm not a farmer, but I am a consumer of food. I could actually see this logo and direct my consumer dollars to support veteran farmers in Wisconsin.
And Senator Teston, as I understand it, this isn't just, hey, you're a veteran who grew up on a farm. We want to help you get into farming. This could be somebody from Representative Goyke's district in central Milwaukee.
Well, absolutely. That's just it. I mean, as Representative Goyke mentioned, this has appeal for both urban and rural areas, your traditional farms, and now when you see aquaculture facilities popping up all across the state, which is really, to me, the future of agriculture. But it's not just for veterans. This is also for Gold Star families. So for those who have lost a loved one in service to this country, they are also going to have the opportunity to participate in this program. And as the representative mentioned, you know, I think all of us would be willing to, when we go down to our farmer's market or our grocery store on the weekend, if we saw, you know, a head of lettuce and we knew it was made by a veteran, I'd be more than willing to spend a few extra dollars knowing that's going to help those individuals and those families who have served.
We're talking about new legislation advancing in the state legislature, aiming at getting some Wisconsin veterans involved in agriculture. State Senator Patrick Teston with us, State Representative Evan Goyke. Want to talk about not the specifics of the legislation, but the process a little bit here. Republican and a Democrat in the room with me, big city, small town. These are groups that don't always work well together, play well together here in the state. Representative Goyke, why is it important for this kind of legislation to bring parties together?
Well, it should be done more often. Obviously, I think voters both in Democratic areas and Republican areas like to see lawmakers and encourage me, and I'm sure encourage Senator Teston to work more often together. But, you know, Senator Teston outlined that this is an issue. There are veteran groups farming 5 blocks from my house in the central city or 50 miles away from my house on an open farm field. And so every corner of the state can benefit from this legislation. And the legislation's moving forward. It's passed the state Senate yesterday. It is hopefully scheduled for a vote next week in the state assembly and has received strong bipartisan support thus far.
And Senator Teston, I've heard from lawmakers sometimes, you know, well, we do cooperate. You guys in the media don't listen when we do it. You focus on the conflict stuff. Is there more of this kind of thing going out there that than we know?
No, I think there absolutely is. In fact, we had a constituent in the office today who was visiting us from Stevens Point coming down to the Capitol, and he asked, you know, what's it like down here? And we actually pulled up the tracker of all the bills that we're currently working on, and I think 90% of them have bipartisan support or bipartisan co-sponsors. And so, you know, there are a lot of issues that we're able to put aside our political differences to do what's best for our constituencies, for our communities, and for our state, because at the end of the day, whether you're Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, we all want what's best for our families. We want what's best for our communities, for our state, and our country. We sometimes have different ways of getting there. I think we all agree on that. But on a lot of these issues, politics don't get interjected into it. And so we're able to sit down, work with one another, and really bring forth good legislation that's to the benefit of the entire state.
We're talking to State Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point and State Assembly Representative Evan Goyke, looking at he's from Milwaukee, about a bipartisan bill they're co-sponsoring that would provide help to Wisconsin veterans as a way to encourage them to get into farming. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the bill? Are you a veteran yourself who wants to know more about the program? If you're a farmer, do you think this is a good plan? Are you looking for someone maybe to take over your operation? You don't have that next generation. Maybe a veteran could be that next generation. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're talking to State Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point and State Representative Evan Goyke of Milwaukee. They're the co-sponsors of a bill that would help veterans in the state become farmers.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a veteran? What are your thoughts on this idea? If you're a farmer, would you like to work with veterans? Are you a veteran who's gone into farming? Maybe you want to give some encouragement to your colleagues. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Before we get to our callers, let's talk about the skills match. You were talking about that a little, Senator Teston. We think of farming sometimes as this rustic, old-fashioned type of thing. And then when you talk to farmers, you find out how high-tech an industry this is. Is that part of why this might be a good match for veterans who are coming from a high-technology military?
I think so. When you take a look at the advances in agricultural technology from even 30, 40 years ago, it's vastly different. I've toured a number of the large operations on in my district, and it's incredible what they're using. I mean, they are using satellite GPS to determine moisture content in the soil so they can change their irrigation practices, to GPS monitors in their trucks so they know that when there's idle time. And so, I mean, a lot of these technologies are the same technologies these veterans use in service. And so to be able to come back from that and then go into a field where they can use the same stuff that they use when they served, I think that's a huge benefit.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Tim is on the line in Juneau. Tim, hi.
Hello. Say, I had a couple quick comments. One is, I think it's a fantastic idea as far as introducing veterans to it. I actually have a friend of mine that was a veteran of the Iraqi War that I introduced to a local farmer friend, and it's been fantastic for him for being able to get his mind off of things, you know, that had happened in the war. I think if it kind of refocuses his life, give him a new purpose, if you will. And he's been very thankful, as is the farmer, for the introduction. He's just helping him. But, you know, that scenario I think is fantastic, because I think it is a good thing for veterans. The thing I have, the concern I always have with this type of stuff is, what about the financials? I mean, I came from a farming background, and I'm not farming because it's just, to be able to take over the family farm, it'd be just overwhelming, especially a lot of the smaller farms. You know, it's a whole different world out there as far as scale of farming today, and to introduce somebody into that type of, you know, even a small scale farm, how do they, you know, overcome that debt load?
Tim, thanks a lot for calling. Representative Goyke, let's start with that second point first. Is there, are they connected, these veterans, maybe, with help to figure out finances of farming?
Yeah, so the direct answer to the question is that the bill itself does not include an appropriation of state funds for veteran farmers. So there isn't grants or loans associated with this bill. But the caller made a really important point about debt and capital and access. I mentioned earlier in the interview that part of the program is to train, educate, and pair veteran farmers with mentors. And the goal in all of that is to make smart financial decisions as farmers, new farmers, enter the profession. And I wouldn't know where to begin on day one. And I would, if it was just me, make a lot of unforced errors. And sometimes that's the difference between, you know, staying in business and not. And so the answer to the question is there's no dollars attached to the to this bill. There may be in the future if this is successful. And one point just to mention is currently we don't know how many veteran farmers we even have in the state of Wisconsin. I can't tell you the need for this at this point. We will know that because of this bill, and maybe Senator Teston and I will be back a year from now with a different bill funding.
And Senator Teston?
So, yeah, I mean, that is a great question. And in some other states that have incorporated programs like this, they do have some sort of financial assistance. From our take, because as Representative Goyke mentioned, we just don't know, you know, how big this program is going to be, how many are going to take advantage of it. So we weren't very prescriptive in the language. We really wanted to leave this up to the departments and the UW extension to let's get this off the ground and see if it takes off. And then from there, if this is really successful, then certainly there's going to be more opportunity down the road to work with Representative Goyke and our colleagues in the legislature to maybe make this a little bit more expansive.
Tim, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Joy on the line in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Hi. I'm happy to hear about this program. It's a positive thing to support really real people. As a nurse, I have a concern, and that is that there is a higher incidence of suicide among veterans, and you've already mentioned that there were veterans that said that they did not want to commit suicide after being in a similar program. But there's also a higher incidence of suicide among farmers because it can be such a hard profession. So I'm wondering how, if the program includes follow-up after someone is trained and matched with a mentor, you know, how long this follow-up might continue to see how, you know, happy they are in the long term.
Joy, thanks for that call. Senator Teston, I know I don't think there's anything specific in the legislation about that, but any thoughts on that topic?
Yeah, there's nothing specific written in the bill to deal with just that, but when you take a look at the statistics nationally, 25 veterans a day take their own lives. And just from the testimony that we had, and it was incredibly powerful testimony that we had in both the Assembly and the Senate hearing of individuals who are dealing with some pretty traumatic service-related industry or injuries and PTSD. And so if this is a chance for them to, you know, maybe get better, get healthy with this new program, as other veterans have in other states like West Virginia, I think this is only going to be a benefit to our veterans.
Do you want to add anything, Representative Goyke?
I would just add that the bill does not put a time limit on how long a veteran farmer can participate. The bill creates an office that would directly support veteran farmers. We've mentioned some of the services like training, education, mentorship. That's just the beginning. And, you know, to the caller's point, one of the groups that we brought to the table here is the Department of Veteran Affairs, which has a lot of services, and each county in Wisconsin has a veteran service officer that can help provide services. We're bringing that department to the table and to veteran farmers with this. So we hope this opens other doors of other programs and services that are already available to our veterans.
Joy, thanks a lot for that call. We have a comment from Brian in Eau Claire. Brian wonders, will this hurt smaller local farms? Will the big, the CAFOs, the larger farms, benefit the most? Is there anything about the scale of farms that you'd be connecting veterans with, Senator Teston?
No, I mean, this is pretty open-ended for all levels of agriculture. What was really interesting when we took a look at what other states are doing, and in fact, in West Virginia, over 300 veterans have been in the program, and they've actually created almost 200 new businesses. But
one of the big things that really took off in West Virginia was beekeeping. And so, I mean, it's pretty interesting. I mean, I went with Representative Goyke to an aquaculture facility in his district back in, what was that, March or May. And really, I mean, there's so many different uses and applications for agriculture that these veterans can be a part of, from large operations to beekeepers.
And I wanted to ask Representative Goyke, what do you, when you think about this becoming law, what does success look like to you? What are you hoping for?
I think success is increasing the number of opportunities for veterans out there. I think of somebody that I don't know, somebody that might not know who I am or will ever vote for me, being able to pursue a love and a passion in farming, whether that's in Milwaukee or Stevens Point.
And Senator Teston, where is this in the legislature right now?
So it just passed the state Senate yesterday unanimously, which was I was very thankful to my colleagues for their support and for all the committee members who voted for it in both the Assembly and the Senate committees. And now it's our hope that the Assembly will vote on this next week. And for us, for Representative Goyke and myself, we really believe this is pro-veteran, it's pro-agriculture, and it's pro-workforce.
And Representative Goyke, Senator Teston, was talking about some possible next steps after this passes, and you see how much interest there is in it. Any other thoughts on what could be a sequel, if that's not looking too far ahead?
I think Senator Teston and the caller both nailed it on the head, which is we need to see what the demand for this program is. We will assess its shortcomings or its successes, and if it's an opportunity to get more capital to new farmers that are veterans, I think you might hear from us in the near future to support that.
And briefly, Senator Teston, you talked about what people who have been through this in West Virginia have said. What kind of testimony did you hear from veterans here in the state?
We had veterans come from every corner of the state, from Milwaukee to Stevens Point, from Prairie du Chien, and the united message was this, is that this is a good piece of legislation, because if this has the potential to help even one veteran, then that's worth it, in their opinions.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks, Senator Teston, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Representative Goyke, thanks for coming back as well.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Senator Patrick Teston, Republican representing Stevens Point in Wisconsin State Senate. Also with us, Representative Evan Goyke, a Democrat representing Milwaukee in the State Assembly. They joined us today to talk about their bipartisan legislation. They co-sponsored that. It's aimed at helping veterans get into agriculture here in Wisconsin. As we've heard, it has passed the State Senate, coming up in the Assembly next week. Wisconsin's Harley-Davidson has hit a bit of a financial pothole. The motorcycle maker again announced disappointing third-quarter earnings last week. The company and some industry analysts say that younger people aren't interested in more expensive, high-powered bikes. Patty Murray reports.
It's the Harley sound. That's a new Harley Street Glide. Harley is introducing the Street Glide for 2018. It's part of a plan to expand its demographic beyond baby boomers. It has a slightly lower price point than other large bikes. There weren't stereotypical tough bikers at a Halloween family event at Doc's Harley-Davidson west of Green Bay this weekend. Mike Hartzheim brought his family to the party. He's a longtime Harley rider and a boomer. He understands that bikes may be out of reach for some.
Motorcycles aren't cheap. I mean, whether it's a Honda or a Harley or whatever, but the starting entry ones are coming down in price, and some of the ones Harley's made changes this year gearing more towards younger people. So once you get somebody's foot in the door, they go from there.
Docks and other Harley dealerships often host family events like this one that even offered something as square as a hayride, and some of the attractions are year-round.
We have a zoo with a camel and a herd of buffalo and alligators and tortoises, and we also have a classic car and cycle.
Kirsten Helling is Doc's daughter and now the general manager of the dealership. She grew up in the industry along with its ups and downs.
Well, the ups have been up enough where we had waiting lists for new motorcycles. That was several years. And downs, Downs haven't really been what I'd consider to be a down, more of just a flat.
When a company's third quarterly profits are down by 40% compared to last year, it might not sound like there's a whole lot to celebrate. Shipments of Harleys were also down by 5,000 bikes in the third quarter. A stock analyst with Edward Jones says Harley's problem seems to be a focus on heavyweight bikes. Robin Dietrich says big, expensive bikes are losing favor worldwide.
With less expensive motorcycles, but also just trying to look for that appeal balance between price and performance that they think will appeal to kind of that younger millennial type of rider. So that's been something they've been focused on for quite a while.
Diedrich recommends a hold status on Harley stock. She says it's not a sell because of the company's plans to introduce more than a dozen new bikes in the next decade. She says it's just not a Harley problem, but one for the whole industry. That echoes comments Harley CEO made to stock analysts last week. Matt Levitich says the company is looking to build on the Asian market.
Well, the U.S. is a mature motorcycle market. We're investing to grow it. As the motorcycle industry leader with 115 years of experience, we believe we're well positioned to build ridership and strengthen the sport of motorcycling over time.
Back at the Halloween party, rider Mike Hartsheim doesn't seem to be too scared over his favorite bike maker's future.
Well, when I come back from a long trip and get on in a car, it feels too easy. You know, motorcycle is just different. You're out in the wind, you're out in the air, you're out in the rain. And rain's not a bad thing, it's just a different way to travel.
And no car sounds like this. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Okay.
As you may have heard, this is Veronica's last day here on the show, which is sad.
It is sad.
And before she goes, we're going to take this last opportunity to do something we've been talking about for the last 4 years.
That's right. We are going to sing. We recorded this earlier. Yeah. We're not going to do it live. It's not quite, you know, it's not polished for Carnegie Hall, but here it is.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me, anyone else but me, anyone else but me. No, 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 don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me till I come marching home.
Yeah.
That's better. I kind of lost it toward the end.
Oh, no. Why did we do that?
We occasionally would do this in the office over the years and always talked about singing on the air. We recorded. That was the second take. I'll be honest. I really botched the first
one. No one needs one to hear the first take.
No. One of us is a real singer, Veronica, and one of us.
Well, you're a real singer and a real sax player. Right. Well, if you want to buy the CD of that, you can call us. You can write me a check. No, probably not.
This is Central Time.